Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
We're here again with Spencer Crooks, who's going to continue to tell us more about the market maker. Spencer, thanks for joining us here again.
My pleasure.
So do you invest your own money now, today?
Yes, I always have done, yeah, I do, yeah.
And how do you use all of your knowledge to get the best price when you're buying and selling?
Speaking to the broker, like I was once a market maker, knowing what broker I think is a good broker, phoning them up, having that trust with them, giving my ideas, listening to their ideas, reading the balance sheet, reading the company's figures, understanding. The other good one is, as well, when the director's buying a lot of stock or selling a lot of stock. I mean, that's a great indicator when you see the company directors putting a lot of their own money in. I mean, that is a great example of where they are, have got skin in the game. Mm. I mean, as Warren Buffett once said, you know, the market is only an entry and exit point. You know? And then Charlie Munger said, and once you find one or two good companies, and just sit on your hands. There's some great companies out there, smaller companies. You know, and I think doing research, and it's all in the common domain. I mean, when a company or board director does buy a load of shares, that's certainly something I look for.
And what do you do on a profit warning?
Either sell them if the model's changed and you think, gosh, you know, the whole model's changed, or that industry's finished, or, you know, okay. Or actually, if it's a short-term blip, then think, actually, I think they're going to turn it around. I mean, one good example was Geared for Music. They had a profits warning, and I noticed, and it was basically the demand was too great, and they couldn't supply all the instruments that they wanted to. They had a logistics problem, So that was a great case where the business is in problem. They've grown so fast they couldn't actually deliver what they wanted. Where other businesses, you think they're in demise. You know, they're contracting. That's over. And so that's why it's important to read. You know, it's very interesting to read, whether it be the FT or any press. You know, Simon Thompson, I think that's one thing he and Joanna Hart, they pick up on. They get that feeling that you know, of that company growth. That's why he has such a following, because more often than not, he's right.
So on the morning of a profit warning, the price can bump around like crazy. Is it helpful, your insight as a market maker, as to what's happening at the other end?
Yes, I think, you know, it all depends what happens to the stock beforehand. You know, the stock might have regressed 10 or 15 or 20% beforehand. So to a great degree, that's in the price, as they say, and then it'll just have another 10 or 15% knock. As I said earlier, if there's a lot of short selling out there, or the market knows there's a large short position out there, then obviously those shorts might decide to close. It's worrying if those shorts increase their shorts, then you know the business is in problem. Mm. So it's all those things you have to take into, size up or assess, basically. Mm. I think it's hard to say generally on this is the template we always do on this basis. It's on a stock-by-stock basis. Mm. It's the management. I mean, if you look at GEC, General Electric, great company, and then change its name to Marconi, it disappeared. Mm. It sold off all the good bits of business, expanded, and then who would have believed that basically GEC went bust? Mm. Well, Marconi did. And a lot of people lost a lot of money, and I can understand why, because they thought of that they were investing in a company of past, and they didn't look in the balance sheet of what was. And that's, you know, it's happened time and time again. Happened in Polypec. And I'm sure it'll happen in many companies in the future. But likewise, there'll be many more fever trees out there, which is why the interest people have in the smaller cap companies. So if you have got a company whereby you understand that the director's got such exposure, or the board have got such exposure, and even if they are selling some shares, they're selling some shares because they're just letting some go because they're, you know, the growth is such, but they've still got a large percentage in the company. you can understand it. I mean, one company was recently, I noticed that Charles Dunstone has bought a massive stake in TalkTalk, increased his stake, you know, many, many millions of pounds. You know, he clearly believes in the product and believes in the business. When he's investing £10 million extra in that business, then you can see why some people are would follow that sort of lead, if that makes sense.
What's interesting, though, is that you're talking very common sense, good practice investing. You're not really saying, because I was an ex-market maker, I know how to buy at the best price. You don't think there's any tricks to the trade?
Oh, there are tricks to the trade. I mean, you know, those tricks to the trade are, you know, using the price. You can use the price on the screen. Obviously, the market always overreacts. It overreacts on the upside or the downside. And that's the art of the market maker. The market maker will know the market's overreacting here. It's cooked too much. Or on the downside, the market will say, no, here, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to buy them.
And you often buy on a profit warning for that very reason.
Yes, if it's at a level that they think, actually, here, this is overdone, that's where, again, the market maker, or if there's a market correction, in, for example, an event happens, I mean, people are still going to buy toothpaste. They're still going to go shopping, buy food. I mean, you know, the world isn't going to end, you know. So the skill and where what we did at Winterflood is invested in those people, because those people, as I said, had a 15, 16-year experience. So on that, they would go, here, boss, you know, it's overdone. So they would mop them up. So, you know, and that's where we'd use our funds, our money, and actually take that position and think, no, the market's overreacted here, and you'd have a large position in that company. And it would vary on that stock-by-stock basis.
And with regulation, has anything changed in being able to do proprietary trading?
Well, proprietary trading, what I mean by that is, when I mean they take a stance, is when their electronic machine is still selling them stock, that they are buying that stock. Does that make sense?
Okay.
That they're actually not openly going in and saying, right, I'm going to mop these things up. But it's if there's an institution that wants to sell them, they go, we've got an institution that wants to sell them. We're going to buy them, boss, here because of this reason. Or if their electronic machine is selling them stock and you go at these levels, I think they're a good buying. So that is creating liquidity, but you would say view that as proprietary. But yeah, we're using our cash, but creating an orderly market.
And has much changed with regulation or, you know, yes, over the 15, 18 years? Did a lot change?
Immense. I think the safety devices are far greater. I think the risk management is far tighter, far greater. I mean, with MiFID II, has that helped the industry? I don't think it has. I think the idea was great, but I think all it's done is burdened it with a cost structure. Has the individual retail investor benefited from it? I don't think they have.
And do you think it's reduced liquidity?
I wouldn't necessarily say it's reduced liquidity to any great degree. I would say certain events have. I mean, for example, I believe that back in the day when it was a quote-driven system, you could probably buy a lump of 1 million, maybe 2 million Vodafone on the touch, and the price wouldn't change because there was a quarter piece spread between the bid and the offer. I think now if you bought 1 or 2 million Vodafone on the order book, you would move the price probably a penny, maybe even penny halfpenny. So then if you understand the cost of executing that 1 million or 2 million shares by constantly buying 10,000 shares, 15,000 shares, 20,000 shares over a period of time at that same price, the cost of executing those orders will be far greater to either the institution or to the individual retail than would have been in buying that one lump in one hit. Does that make sense? Who's benefited from that? The LSE or the person on the order book? Because they get a profit each time the person takes the clip off the screen. But has the individual? Not really, I don't think. I don't think they have at all. But I can see why they've tried to do it. And they've obviously, with MiFID II, they've tried to show each of the cost structure, you know, what is research worth? What is it breaking down? But has the individual really benefited? I don't think they have.
There's a complaint that perhaps over the last 2 years, liquidity has diminished substantially, and maybe that's just the market environment that we're in at the moment.
I think so. I think it possibly is the market environment. I would say it's a tougher environment out there for the market makers and for the brokers because of the implementation of MiFID II, because of the more staff that are required. Fees have not gone up, they've actually decreased, commission rates have gone down, and less volume, less IPOs. They're all negative. But you've got to wrap that up in the current time scale of Brexit. So all those things have created the perfect storm. Mm. I mean, you need the broker, you need the market maker. Mm. They provide both provide an excellent service, and the race to zero isn't a good race to zero because good business is when everyone makes a profit because you want them there tomorrow.
So where do you see tomorrow happening? You know, for the next 5 years, what do you see going forward?
It could do a total reversal. It could go more to single capacity. You come more specialists. I think certainly in the small arena, you're going to have that because the specialist broker, whether he does the field of beverages and engineering or, you know, there is a demand. There's quality brokers because if you get a quality broker, as you just mentioned, if they are a price, a good broker will keep you in touch with developments of the company, tell you, by the way, there's a lump on offer or have you seen the note here? And for their fee, you're getting that service. If you just want to buy 1,000 shares, then, you know, that equally is fine. But there's varying degrees of retail brokers or retail clients, I should say. And the retail client isn't like it was in when Sid came onto the format and British Gas time. He's far sharper, far more understanding now. Hence, look at Hargreaves Lansdowne, how they've grown. I mean, that's a great business. There's more at your fingertips now, where before, pre-Big Bang, there wasn't. With the computer now, everything's so much more accessible.
So this is good for brokers and for market makers.
Yeah.
So it could be positive.
Yeah, I think I'm not negative. I think it's going through a change, shall we say.
And do you think liquidity will return again? It's just the economic environment.
Yes.
Because there has been concerns that it's been driven institutionally and that banks aren't trading as much and all sorts of stories.
I think, as I said, I think there's been a demise in the banks. I think the cost structure is unsustainable for the banks. I mean, in fairness, there's been a retrenchment of European banks because of the compliance is where the US has got sort of a far lighter touch to it. So they've still been able to expand and progress, but the European banks have had a tougher time of it, hence why. But I think the game's changed generally anyway. It's with everything disclosed, it's everyone can see what print you deal at, what size you've dealt at. And it doesn't always work to the advantage of the individual or anyone else.
The Woodford situation, you think that hits and impacts small caps? Because institutions will be less keen to go into small caps.
Well, I did not say in the institutional side. I think actually the poor retail investor has been hit there because there was in their view a brand name which they trusted, and sadly that hasn't been the case. The fund's performance and the fund's exposure has been such that it's not what they expected or anticipated. And I think that's again, negative for the stock market, negative for the market in general, market makers, brokers, because you want the retail investor there. You don't want them, you want people to prosper. You don't want the Neil Woodfords of the world to have these problems. Yeah. But it's very easy to pick on the negative. You know, you must understand there's a lot of very good institutions out there. I mean, look at Terry Smith, mm-hmm. Fund Smith. I mean, you know, there's a great example. There's Nick Twain, mm-hmm. again. So so for every negative, I think there's a positive. So mm-hmm. it's important not to get wrapped up in it too much in that respect. I mean, as I said earlier, people are still going to buy food. They're still going to buy their toothpaste. They're still going to go on a holiday. Sadly, the Thomas Cooks of the world and those things, the retail investor's got his fingers burnt.
Mm. And just to go back to some of the technical terms for market makers, what are dark pools? You referred to them earlier, but what are dark pools?
Dark pools are where certain names, where institutions do not want to disclose that they are a buyer or seller, will pitch offer a stock or buyer of stock within that price. You don't know how big it is. You don't know when it starts. You don't know anything. He can pull the order at any time. So if a share price is £2.50.4 to £2.50.6, that's a spread on, say, a order-driven stock, there might be a seller at whatever that mid price is, whether it goes up or down. He might have it for a set period and you don't know who the seller is or who the buyer is, but it's going through one of the dark pools. It might have been, there's several, half a dozen dark pools you can go through. And for that, he wants to be anonymous.
And you're speaking as a market maker now, so yes. You have no idea who institution is, no. And you've no idea what volume he's got.
No idea what volume. It could be for an hour, it could be for the whole day, it could last a week, it could be for 30 minutes.
And you just know it's there because every time you try and
if you try to take the stock on the order book, you immediately, if it, or you put an order up in the mid price, and immediately you're executed and filled.
And it depends what you're trying to do, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah. But that their way is they want to stay anonymous for whatever reason.
And if you were an institution, do you think that's a good way to behave? Or do you think you'd get a better deal if you went to a market maker and told them what you were trying to do?
Well, in fairness, it usually, the dark pools usually happen in the more liquid stocks. And I would say there's a reason they want to be anonymous. If it is a very well-known fund, the reason they don't want that order, because they don't want other people being told that they are buying that stock, whether it be for someone of great name like Warren Buffett or historically Neil Woodford or Terry Smith. They don't want that in the public domain because they don't want that reaction happening, everyone following them in or following them out before they've executed their order. So from that point of view, I can understand where they're coming from.
So can you talk me through tree shakes?
Tree shakes, yes. It's basically if a stock's had a good run, moved upwards, and you've got any sort of day traders or, shall we say, short-term investors, and then they are constantly screen-watching or monitoring the price, and then as soon as it turns negative or goes into the dips, you might want to sell stock. So it's what we call tree shaking that tree, seeing any loose holders, and if you tick them down and call them down again and call them down again, you might create some selling interest.
So that creates extra volume for
yes.
you.
Yeah.
And is that the sole motive for it?
That's one possibility. The other possibility is that you actually generally might feel the stock has gone far enough. Looking at, again, if with the interest and the knowledge of the companies, you might think, actually, these are trading way beyond what they can really achieve. Mm. In short term, as I said earlier, the market always overreacts on the upside and the downside. Mm. Both are equal. So that's where the market maker is thinking, you know, hang on a minute, things are overcooked here. Things have gone too far. Shake that tree. Mm-hmm. Get some stock in, because he might want to buy some stock because he might be short, and he might have, you know, sold shares a lot lower down. So actually, even though it's not going to create a profit for him, it's actually reducing that exposure, what's called a bear exposure. It's reducing that exposure. then obviously the benefit is the retail broker, if he thinks you're wrong, he'll buy them just cheaper than he could have bought them earlier.
Although sometimes what happens is that the bid and offer just get further and further apart. Is that a tree shape?
No, that's not. Different? They don't widen the spread. No.
Okay.
Sometimes it does. That would be a order-driven market rather than a quote-driven market.
Okay.
So basically, not a quote-driven. So where that will happen, where all the bids are filled in.
Okay.
On the order book. So that's where you'll see. So if they are, and then basically what happens there is there's a safety mechanism that the exchange puts in, and then it goes into auction.
Yeah.
So effectively, if there is a profits warning, for example, the bids are all filled in before that, the price spikes downwards, it moves a certain percentage, and then it goes into auction and it rebases.
Okay.
That's where the offer stays the same and the bid disappears. Or vice versa, if there's a bid for the company.
Okay.
If there's a bid for the company, the bid stays the same, all the offers are taken out, and then it automatically goes into an auction to rebase, and then the percentage safety net will rebase as well on that new on-crossing price. Does that make sense?
Yeah, completely. So on a tree shake, how often would you see a tree shake across, say, in your office when you're trading everything? Would there be one or two tree shakes a day, or would there be, I mean, how regular are they?
The market manager might think these things are high enough now, you know, or you know, he might say, yeah, I'll happily sell them. So it's, in trading, it would be a usual occurrence, if that makes sense. You know, on the downside, you think, actually, you know, not even a tree shake, you know, they're falling far enough now. No, let's up they go. Let's move them upwards.
Burford claimed that Muddy Waters have been spoofing and layering. Do you think that goes on, and does it go on often?
I think today's world of litigation, you can't throw these spurious accusations without having some facts. So I think if it does, it's a very dodgy line to go on. I think on posting, some people post things on these chat formats. I'm sure it goes on there if it isn't regulated. But if it is regulated, I would say it's going to come back to bite you. So I would say there has to be some fact or reason to say anything, because otherwise you're going to go see yourself with litigation in the law courts.
So just explain to us what spoofing and what is layering. So
spoofing and layering is saying ill truths. You know, it's basically just saying stuff which isn't factually correct. So, you know, in today's world, I think in Burford Capital situation, their accounting policy is where they were questioning. But to say that you're saying ill truths, I don't think that goes on. And if it does go on, I think there'll be a court action against them.
But with the spoofing and the layering, that was much more a market term, in that they were showing trades that didn't actually exist and removing them as before they...
Yeah, well, layering is known as layering, and layering is an illegal. So I would say the market, as in the LSE or whoever is policing that, I know when I was at Winter Floods, we had a very good relationship with the London Stock Exchange. And if there was any layering, we'd speak to them or they'd speak to us. We'd have a dialogue with them. So The nice thing is the platform where the layering or the spoofing or the fictitious pricing has gone on will be all traceable. They'll know what house has done it or what firm's done it or what broking house has done it, and they will be there will be retribution to be had. So they won't get away with it, because if they were doing that, the exchange, whatever exchange is, will be wrapping their knuckles.
So you'd say that Burford have got a pretty strong case in order to make that claim?
If there was layering or spoofing, or then obviously the investigation will show that that was the case. There may have been a client order which the client decided to pull those orders because of the price was at such a level that they no longer wanted to get involved. There may be many things, obviously, which I'm not privy to.
But that's a thin line, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is a thin line. And it's got to know who the client was and everything else. So that's something that in the public domain, we're not privy to.
Mm. But is spoofing and layering common?
No. No. And no, because there's so many surveillance teams now.
Great.
Which is probably why that got such publicity.
Because
if there is that accusation that there is, that's why, because it doesn't happen.
Talk me through algorithmic trading. Everyone seems to think that that's sort of affecting the markets these days. Does it affect the markets?
Yes, it does. It affects the market in the larger order-driven stocks. Obviously, it doesn't affect them in the quote-driven stocks because they're a quote-driven stock. But obviously, which goes without saying, because obviously the market maker is selling the benchmark price. But where the order-driven market is, algorithmic trading certainly does, yes. For example, some institutions or hedge funds might want to trade over the day, and then there's other funds that have AI which reads the way it goes. So they have black box machines which effectively read the prints and trades ahead of the prints. Very quick, hundreds of milliseconds. But algorithmic trading does happen, and it happens in the liquid order-driven market.
And more in America or just more in large caps?
I would say probably a lot more in America. Mm-hmm. And due to happening so much in America, it came over here. Mm. The question has been, with algorithmic trading, what orders are genuine? That we don't know, because it's a black box.
Interesting. But it only affects like FTSE 100, doesn't affect 250?
I would say it probably affects some 250 stocks, yes. Yeah, because obviously some FTSE stocks are demoted to 250. Don't forget there's a re-weighting every time. Mm. So if they're a liquid 250 stocks, it wouldn't surprise me if the algorithmic trading happens in those stocks, 100%.
And these are companies that are specifically set up to trade algorithmically, or they're large banks?
Could be both. The algorithmic trading could be done by the large banks.
Okay.
By their own algorithms.
Okay.
For clients.
Okay.
There's many, many angles to that.
And then there'll be funds and ETFs, presumably, that are all traded algorithmically.
Yep.
So, and is it getting bigger and bigger?
It has been. Whether it still is now, I don't know. But yes, it has been. Algorithmic trading has been the key because you can write whatever program you want. There's certain companies which dominate it and are pioneers in it. And they are very, very profitable. I would not like to disclose those, but I know of them and they are very, very good. They have got some excellent quants who write the programs for them.
But does it create a more efficient market?
No.
It just creates an opportunity for those good algorithmic traders to make more money.
Yeah. It's the programs that make the money, not the traders. It's the quants that write the programs.
Can we talk about RSP, retail sales price?
Yes. Retail sales price, or RSP. We are an RSP, Winterflood Securities. We've got our own electronic engine called Winner. And that is a retail service price for all brokers. All the brokers can access that. And we will give a two-way bid and offer price on any securities we trade in.
So that then gives you...
During market hours, by the way.
Okay. So that then gives you the sort of micro picture. When I talked about level two being a larger picture...
Absolutely.
Then the RSP gives you the micro picture.
It gives you the micro picture, and obviously it will disclose what price and size it trades during market hours, and it will give a two-way price. It might be skewed, as in skewed price-wise or skewed size-wise. It will give usually a far larger size than is shown on the screen and a far more competitive price. So that's why Winterflood dominates that area electronically. We went into that field in 1997 and in 2000, 2001, we developed our own engine called the Winner Engine. So basically all brokers, if they connect up to us, can get an electronic price to buy or sell any security. Varies on size, and depending the price, the improvement could be quite substantial, but that depends on the difference between the bid and offer, the spread. So if the spread is larger, we might be buying them either for Winterflood Securities as just a liquidity provider. We might be buying them for a broker. As I touched on earlier, we just taking commission. We might be buying them for an institution. We might be very passive and quiet, but just want to mop up because the institution or the broker wants us to mop up the stock, or the broker might be mopping them up for the company. In the past, I've done quite a few schemes for employees of companies, large companies, or director spies, director sales. So again, you want them an orderly market, a nice passive market. You don't want the market to understand what you're doing. It's a great orderly market. So in that situation, my RSP, I'll sort of tweak accordingly to attract all the flow and the size in the direction that I want.
But you might not execute at the price that you're offering on the RSP.
No, I'll always give a two-way price, but I might give enhanced improvement on the bid or enhanced offer, depending if I've got an order which specifically that I... So I'll be an aggressive seller or an aggressive buyer within that price, if that makes sense. So electronically, I know I'm the best bid or the best offer.
And does it amalgamate all the market makers, or is that just Winterflood's?
There is a platform called ProQuote, and where it amalgamates all the RSPs. So for example, if a broker can go on to Chris's the platform and sees what RSPs are out there, all RSPs show what price. So there might be in one stock three RSPs. There might be in another stock five RSPs. They vary per stock for whatever reason. On those RSPs, some RSPs can be better. They might be the shop broker, so they might have a particular angle to play. We are on all of them. So the broker, whoever that broker may be, can push his little machine and see who is the best bid and who is the best offer. It might be Winterflood, the best offer, and it might be Peel Hunt, for example, the best bid, or Shore Capital, or Numis, or whoever the case be. So they can clearly see who is buying and who is selling and the size they're indicating.
Can you ever imagine that becoming something that would be accessible to retail, like level two is to retail?
No, but you could phone up your broker and say, you know, what are they?
Yeah.
And he'll say X, and you say, oh no, is that the best price, or what are they showing? And he might say, well, the RSP is currently, you can get X or seller Y. But in Venice, once they phone the market maker in question, that market maker in question might have a far bigger size, or might be buying them for a broker, another broker institution. He might say, the reason I'm buying so much is there's rumour they're being tipped by Simon Thompson, or there's rumour there's a, you know, the figures are due tomorrow, and we think they're going to be good because they've under... It could be any number of situations.
But the RSP is always finer detail on what level two is and the yellow strip is.
Yeah.
It'll never be outside of that.
No.
Okay.
Unless the RSP, you might have the option to, if you wanted to buy a lump, but no. It's always, it's for the retail broker, and even institutions probably get it as well, actually. And do you want to access it? Absolutely. But it's all of them, all the RSPs. So varying which ones are signed up, each stock has a different number of RSPs.
So you think you'd always get a cheaper rate by speaking to your broker than you would by trading electronically?
I don't tend to trade electronically anyway, just because invariably when I want to trade the size I want to trade, I want to trade usually normal, larger than market size.
Yeah.
And also, because of my age, I prefer to speak to someone anyway rather than do anything electronically.
Yeah.
So I'm quite happy to have a chat and then, you know, ask about the market and then, you know, because there's always something I might have missed, which isn't particularly hard.
So what's your view on direct market access, particularly as a market maker? Is it a good thing?
I would say for a market maker, obviously, no, because you don't want individuals having direct market access. You'd rather them go through you as an individual. I would think that frequent traders or professional traders use that direct market access. General retail investors don't and wouldn't. I don't know the cost structure of how the brokers issue that or offer that. I know TD Waterhouse used to, which has been taken over by Interactive Investor, but I'm sure there is a certain standard and professionalism and frequency of trade that they require or the individual has to perform to get that access. Probably day traders, but that's the only thing I would say is the day traders.
You didn't notice a change to your profitability once direct market access was offered?
No.
So how often does the market maker get it wrong?
Well, hopefully not too often, but quite frequently. Sadly, more than I like to say, you know, there's been some very, very costly days. So the view that market makers get it right all the time, I can tell you categorically that's not the case. But basically, you want to get it right 6 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
You just want to get it right more often than you get it wrong. But there's always situations. I mean, it's human. Who would have thought what happened with Neil Woodford?
Yeah.
Classic case. You know, I think there's a saying, the first cut is the cheapest with market makers. You know, when you got it wrong, you know you got it wrong. You put your hands up and if you can get out, get out. But market, you get it wrong daily. It's just overall, you want to get it right. You know, get that balance. It's like private investing with market making. You're never going to get in the bottom and you're never going to sell at the top. But you just want to get a little bit in between, if that makes sense. And then, like I said earlier about the momentum, once the market maker understands there's a positive momentum here, whether it's a Simon Thompson or a Joanna Hart, you know that momentum's going to continue up for a period of time.
Mm.
Might be one day, might be 2 days, might be 3 hours, to a level that actually, the market maker might want to get them to a level where he know there's an institutional seller or an institutional buyer. So he said, well, let's get them up to that level as soon as we can. So we actually can do the two-way trade. That's where the market making come in handy. I know there's interest at this level. They've been tipped as a sell. Let's get them down to that level and let's try and get that institutional order filled for him so he can buy them at that cheaper level. Rather than the daily drip, drip, drip. So a market maker will prefer to rebase that, even if it costs them a lot of money. You'd rather rebase 100,000 shares than rebase 1 million shares. Does that make sense? Because it, even though it's costly to rebase 100,000 shares, it's cheaper than rebasing 1 million shares.
And by going to that level, you already know that level has got demand in the market.
And then you can start trading again. And then if you're trading and turning over, then you've got a chance to what's called jobbing it back, making your money back. Just slowly. It's a cut of 1,000 deaths, isn't it? You know, or vice versa. You know, if you've got a bear and it keeps going up, if a short position it keeps going up, you might as well get that bear right up and to a level where there is some selling. So hence the market maker's ability is to find an area where the stock will trade.
Spencer, thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
Your time.
Lovely to meet you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.